Mira Nakashima, Shop Hero. In 1991, I spent the better part of a year acting in a tour of a theater adaptation of the Iliad entitled Kabuki Achilles. The lion's share of this time was spent at a venerable regional theater outside of Philadelphia, the People's Light and Theater Company. The theater subsisted peacefully in the pastoral town of Malvern along what is referred to as the Main Line, a string of old-money communities lining the original vein of the Pennsylvania Railroad. The wealthiest Philadelphia families knew what they were doing when they scooped up large estates in the region, because it is jaw-droppingly gorgeous country, softly rolling hills draped in a proliferation of deciduous forest. As you'll learn later in the book, Pennsylvania is from whence Christian Bexfort selects his cherry lumber stock. I had an absolutely idyllic time living in the region, performing for pay at a respected theater and exploiting the local Yuengling Brewery's 16-ounce returnable brown bottle policy by the case. Delicious living indeed. A goodly portion of life in my early 20s was also very Japanese-flavored, artistically and aesthetically. Because of the profound influence that my sensei, Shōzō Sato, had upon my life and career, Kabuki Achilles was his production. We had already toured Japan and Europe. I was rather invested in the colors and design details of traditional Japanese arts. Among the many artistic gifts he had bestowed upon the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign was the funky and resplendent Japan House, a two-story clabbered farmhouse that he had gutted and refitted with all the trappings of traditional Japanese tea house culture. All this background information came solidly roiling back as I rolled into the Nakashima Woodworker Studio in April 2016. About an hour northeast of Malvern, in the sleepy little town of New Hope, Pennsylvania. April 4th it was, to be exact, because the cherry tree in the middle of the compound was in verdant blossom. Because of the area's resemblance to the wooded hills around Malvern, I felt a strong sense of nostalgia as I parked my rental. Once I poked my head into the office, the déjà vu kicked up tenfold because of the overwhelmingly Japanese flavor to the design of all the buildings. How strange that my experience in the hills of Pennsylvania should always be rife with my reverence for Japanese culture. I have long been a fan and student, via his writing and his actual furniture work, of the late George Nakashima, best known for his unique style of Japanese-flavored design, often utilizing live-edged tree slabs and organic lines and textures. In fact, I wrote a chapter about him in my last book, Gumption. I had been quite familiar with the bullet points in his life story, including the establishment of this eclectic compound of buildings in which I now stood, enjoying the damp quiet and the sweet, occasional bird song. For some reason, and I guess this is a testament to the fact that virtual or secondhand information can never substitute for the real McCoy, it had not occurred to me in my reading just how familiar it all would seem. Perhaps my laser focus on the furniture in the rooms and the photographs had occluded the peripheral views of the setting, architecture, and decor, which were just as powerfully executed by George himself. After all, he was a talented and accomplished architect long before he ever picked up a dovetail chisel. Because of my rich and specific personal history, in the very small middle of a Venn diagram overlapping the terrain of Chester and Bucks counties with woodworking, with green tea incense, with wabi-sabi, with traditional Japanese tatami mats, the sense of homecoming that struck me as I entered the small Nakashima showroom office was profound. My sensei, Shōzō, had been such a unique character in the midst of the cornfields of Illinois that I had always attributed his incredible style to his own idiosyncrasies, which were indeed prevalent, but what hadn't occurred to me, because I am generally ignorant, also known as blissful, was that Shozo's brand of magic was also dripping with tradition. Sheepishly greeting the benevolent workers at the Nakashima studio, I was surprised to find that I felt very emotionally warm and so much more acclimated to the people there than I would have expected. It felt so familiar that I wanted them to put me to work. Sadly, they did not allow me to get my hands dirty. Instead, I was offered tea or coffee by George's daughter, the matriarch well-versed in woodshop comportment upon whom this chapter relies, Mira Nakashima. I was quite moved by her generosity in touring me about the buildings and grounds and fascinating me with the historical lineage of each structure. Born in 1942 in Seattle, Washington, Mira got a very early lesson in American fear and racism. Not long after she came into this world, her parents were sent, with her in tow, to a Japanese internment camp in Idaho during World War II. Shortly after regaining their freedom, the young and plucky Nakashimas were able to set up shop on a piece of wilderness in New Hope, where they lived in a tent until her dad began to construct the shop and other buildings. He built the shop before the house. Young Mira's intention was far from following in her father's footsteps by becoming a woodworker. She said that she had really wanted to study music or languages, but her overweening father insisted that she should study architecture instead. So she attended Harvard University, where she could, quote, still do choral society and dance group, so it was okay, end quote. She then followed that up with a master's degree in architecture from Tokyo's Waseda University before returning to the States. In hindsight, it's easy to examine the arc of a person's life or career with a discerning eye, but when we're actually living through that lifespan, its destination is not so clear. Luminaries and legends, as well as abject failures, are often just trying to make their rent or get kissed or both. Looking back on Mira's history, I see less of a future American furniture scion and more of a valued young daughter at the family's studio furniture operation, an operation that just happened to catch the nation's fancy in a very big way. In 1970, her dad built her a house across the road from the studio and offered her a part-time job. She told me that she started out as more of a gopher, juggling three little ones and the random needs of the other studio employees. In an interview with Craft in America, she said, "I was pretty much the understudy. He never told me the way to do things. He would just change a drawn line without telling me why. I can't count the number of times I was fired while Dad was alive. It was very good discipline." Thankfully, the firings were never permanent, as Mira continued to doggedly learn how to design her father's tables, chairs, and consoles. One thing that really struck me upon visiting was the disparity between the fantasy and the reality of what I had imagined the Nakashima studio must be like. I suppose all those years of admiring their work in books and magazines and museums conjured a vision in my mind's eye of a wizardly woodshop deep in the forest. An eldritch place where the very trees flexed themselves into majestic burls, emblazoned with ponderously spalted hieroglyphs and the most dazzling of quilted figures, then slowly shambled to the shop door, upon which a stiff breeze would cause them to knock, presenting themselves as an offering to the sawyers of the great halls of Nakashima. In reality, here was a shop that required no magic at all, beyond a father's exquisite vision and philosophy and his daughter's adherence to those qualities. A daughter who said, "Dad really believed that there are spirits in the wood that enhance people's lives. And you know, not everybody can live in the woods, but they can live with wood and stay connected to nature and to the divine in that way." Here was the woodshop I had been emulating all my woodworking life, one where they fully respect the concept of wabi-sabi. In a 2012 interview on the 189.com, Mira has said that, We depend entirely on the natural shapes and colors of the wood to inspire and determine the course of our work, and never apply artificial colors or shiny finishes. Neither do we. I knew glossy finishes were for the birds. Sorry, I got excited. Of course, glossy finishes have their place in 1987. I kid. My enthusiasm, however, to see every nook and corner of this elfin compound was no joke. A business that remained successful despite designing furniture pieces one at a time in a painstaking way that was true to the particular qualities of the wood itself and also of the client's needs. It is actually very problematic to respect and honor natural forms, so that each piece is individual and different from the next, said Mira, again in 2012. As this artistic process is not at all cost-effective, we have historically sold only directly to clients, eliminating the middleman markup of modern entrepreneurship. Well, this was something incendiary indeed to inspire all of us little shops who are striving to profit by the same business model. If you're not aware, when you sell a piece for $100 at a show, the gallery will usually take 50 of those dollars from you. Showing your work in a gallery is a luxury that can prove very dear. What further struck me as I drooled over the 1965 Hornbach Zuckerman 32-inch planer and the 1964 Hornbach 25-inch joiner was this. So many of us woodworkers have been emulating this style for decades. I have simply arrived at Studio Furniture Nirvana. This is where they made it this way first, and it is where they make it this way best. George may have built this ship, but it is Mira who now stands confidently at the helm. The thing is, she is sailing on very different seas nowadays, 26 years after George's passing in 1990. Her dad once said, "If we end up with something that pleases us and pleases others, then we feel that the destiny of a piece of wood has been fulfilled." Mira says that she just sort of picked up the pieces where George had let them fall, that she's tried to continue his tradition and explore it a little further. Well, that is an understatement very representative of the humility with which she has donned the captain's hat. As you might imagine, a lot of the clientele lost interest in new Nakashima commissions once her dad was no longer around. This served as quite a wake-up call to Mira, who had become a talented, fully skilled designer in her own right by this point. She was grateful that family friend Bob Abel of Philadelphia's Modern Gallery encouraged her to have a show of her new designs sponsored by him. Up until that point, she hadn't understood the importance of PR and creating proper slides of one's work in the pre-digital age. With Abel's support, she debuted her new line of Nakashima Studio pieces, entitled Keisho, which in Japanese simply means continuation, which I think is as touching a title as it is apt. Public interest in the continuing production of the studio called Nakashima Woodworker blossomed once again and has yet to abate. Mira may have unintentionally backed into the stewardship of the Nakashima line, but once she found her feet, she has taken to it like a duck to water. I could go on for many more pages about the Nakashima woodshed alone. I spoke to the woodworkers there of canoes and joinery and tools, and yes, of course, television. I was nothing short of besotted with Mira's grace and strength as the figurehead of this groovy furniture concern in the woods of Pennsylvania. Her dad was an amazing firebrand in 20th century American furniture, a gene that has clearly been passed on to her here in the 21st. There is perhaps no better representation of the enduring mastery passed from father to daughter than the perpetuation of their Altars for Peace project. In Mira's words, "In 1984, a huge and beautiful walnut log appeared, and my father dreamed that its most perfect use would be to construct peace altars for the world from its enormous planks. He designed, built, and installed the first one at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City in 1986, and was hoping to send one to Russia when he passed away in 1990. Since then, we have installed one at the Academy of Arts in Moscow in 2001 and sent one to Auroville, India in 1996, where it was finally dedicated in the Hall of Peace, Unity Pavilion, there in 2014. We were able to establish a global connection between these three sacred tables in 2011, 2014, and 2016, and hope to send a fourth one to the Desmond Tutu Peace Center in Cape Town, South Africa, sometime in the future. We are open to suggestions on other continents where a very large altar/table might be placed and put to use by an organization devoted to world peace. In India, they believe that beauty is man's connection to the divine, Mira said in her Craft in America piece. I can then safely say, in my piece, that I experienced a great deal of beauty during my visit to Mira's studio. Ignorantly, I emailed Mira later to ask if that had been a cherry or a dogwood tree in blossom when I visited. She replied, yes, that is indeed cherry, the single-petal variety called Yoshino in Japanese. Give it up, people.